You are listening to Radio Albion.
Hello, this is Matthew Raphael Johnson. I am the host of this lecture series called the Orthodox Nationalist, or the Russian Orthodox Nationalist, here on Radio Albion. And today is the 10th of September, 2023. I want to give an example of a couple of people who've been supporting me financially in a lot of other ways over the years. Now, I don't know if I can mention their names. I'll mention first names. People send me books and gifts of various kinds. There's a guy from Oregon who sent me a group of, I think more, you know, recently minted Confederate coins. I have someone, a guy named George, sending me stamps, which is something I would never think to send, but it is very helpful. My friend from upstate New York, Tom, who sends me checks of exactly $40 on a regular basis. And they sent it to my P.O. box in Tyre Hill, which is on the website. And I don't get down to check it very much, so I'm always delayed. I still have a book review to do for a new publisher who sent me an English translation, Germany Against the West, in English, published during the era of the Third Reich, which I still haven't gotten to. But sometimes it takes me a very long time to respond. On Patreon, it's extremely difficult, because it is the slowest website I've ever had anything to do with, although I do appreciate them, and that's a great way to donate to me. Someone else sent me a money order, then sent me an extra $50 for Sven, and a few other people are doing that, and I just cash that and add another $50 to his monthly little stipend that I'm trying to give him. I do give him every month. And don't forget, Sven Longshanks, I've heard that because of staff shortages, he has been in 23-hour lockdown, which I think it may be underestimated just how painful that is. He better have a good cellmate. And it's not because he's being singled out or anyone got in trouble. It's just a matter of staff shortages. Maybe the typical overreaction to COVID may give him a break, and I hope to God that's the case. But he needs your letters, he needs your prayers, he needs your donations. We have all the links here on Radio Albion how to do all this. I've done it all, and they all work. You know, they're not scams, or they're not just something that's ignored by the administration. In Britain, it's a little different than it is in this country, which is a good thing in our case. But what I'm going to talk about today is not entirely unrelated to that, because it's a topic that comes up in times of severe stress, of apostasy, of revolution. It's something that I've been researching for a long time. It's not the easiest topic, because it often shows up in poetic form, which is very difficult to translate. I only know the literal stuff, and even that, but it's a struggle. And that is the invisible city of Kitej. It's a city, especially in the minds of the old believers who've really taken this as a central core idea, and really in terms of Russian culture, it's a critical conception. It's a semi-utopian. I only say semi-utopian because a utopia, by definition, has to have a great amount of detail. It has to be not just a blueprint, but a blueprint with a detailed description of the bits and pieces about what make it up. This is not like that. We'll get into exactly what it is here in a minute, but it's a, for the old believers, it's what's left of the true church existing underwater and in a spiritual state. It is largely a spiritual entity that is their Shambhala. You know, we spoke of the Tsar Michael II. You go back a few years in my archives, you could see another old believer idea. I think there's more history there. But this, I mean, it was a literal place. And the Chronicles, going back to the Middle Ages, there's a few errors in there, which make it difficult. But it's a city that exists only for the righteous, only for those who are pure, both in heart as well as in doctrine. And it's under the waters of Lake Svetlyar, near Lower Novgorod. And it's sunk under the surface as a means of escaping the Mongols. It's not a punishment, in fact, it was a blessing. There's something vaguely similar to this in old Byzantium. I've mentioned it before, where at the time of the fall of the city, the liturgy was going on at, of course, Hagia Sophia, and as they broke into the cathedral, the clergy went into the wall, where, again, in the same kind of mentality, they still exist in spiritual form and will come out when the city is in proper hands. The arrogant can never see it. Heretics can't see it. People who are demanding miracles and proofs can't see it. And especially since the revolution, it's taken on a brand new meaning. It's been abused, of course. Marxists and certain of the symbolists have abused it beyond belief. I mean, at a minimum, saying that because it's, you know, in this semi-existent state, it proves that Holy Russia never existed. I mean, stupid things like this. But it is, today it's seen as this general symbol of utopianism. But it's far deeper than that. And we start with the legend of the city of Kitej, which is a cycle of poetic legends. And there's two sources here. The Kitej Chronicle, which says that it's written in September in the year 6646, which is 1237. And it contains the story about the foundation of the great city and the little city of Kitej by George Vsevolodovich of Suzdal, who died in 1238. Vsevolodovich was in power there in Vladimir Suzdal during the invasion of Batu Khan. And the other one, the tale of the secret city of Kitej, is a apocryphal story about an earthly paradise, also of medieval background. And in the archives in St. Petersburg and Moscow, there are 12 remaining copies of these, produced in the 18th and 19th century. But it became the touchstone for the Bishop of Botsy, especially in the 18th century, the priestless old believers. Now, in the oldest group of legends of this city that we have, it came from Vladimir Suzdal and Lower Novgorod, including the region around the lake itself, come from an oral tradition. And it derives from the exile of the pagans, especially the elite Magus, the Magi, from lands under St. Yaroslav the Wise in the Kievan era. And then with the foundation of the monastery in Little Kitej, there's two of them, in 1164. That's the origin. And then, of course, more importantly, they deal with the destruction of the cities of northeastern Russia by the troops of Batu Khan in the 13th century. The uprising of the Magi, which I don't think I've mentioned before, mostly come from nearby Novgorod. And the Novgorod prince Yaroslav traveled to curb this. And this particular brand of paganism was connected to the oligarchy that always ruled that city. So it was relatively unpopular when Yaroslav came around. After the rebellion, there was a famine. And actually, some of these people went to the Bulgars on the Volga. These aren't Bulgarians necessarily. They were descendants or at least allies of the Khazars. And to get them they were the only ones who had food nearby. And some of the pagans decided, or the wise men, the Magi, decided not to return and founded a city in the Volga, which is given the old name Kitish. But that's a different story. Now, the town of Gordets was founded in 1164 by St. Andrei Bogolubsky, great monarch, on the site of my little Kadesh. Here, archaeologists have discovered a settlement, an ancient settlement surrounded by a rampart. There's a lake there with a similar name, Svetluziro, which is close to Svetlua, which, according to legend, was a site where a monastery went underground, either literally or metaphorically. The reason is not clear. More specifically here, St. George Vsevolodovich II, Grand Duke of Vladimir Suzdal, so a core area of old Russia, the origin of Moscow, or the Muscovite idea. He made war on Batu, and the story has the same kind of spirit as the martyrdom of St. Mikhail of Chernigov, Macarius of Smolensk, etc. He was canonized. St. Yuri of Suzdal usually is how he's termed. There's a chronicle of the murder of the Blessed Prince, which is part of this cycle. So there is historical reality here. And for geographers, it became the main source of information about his life. So initially, Grand Duke George, dealing with enemies amongst the Bulgars, former Khazars, as well as the Mongols, he first built the city of Little Kitej on the Volga, where we're talking about here a minute ago. Then he went to Lake Svetlar, where he built the city of Great Kitej. So the Mongols always had a problem with the northern part of Russia, especially in the swamps near Novgorod, which is one of the reasons they didn't penetrate that far. Somehow they could come across 1,000 miles of ice and snow with 300,000 horses, but when the swamps are concerned, they fall apart. The Mongol story, as you know, I've said 100 times before, is iffy, especially from an ethnic point of view. They were occupied, of course, but not necessarily by Jackie Chan. These were people, at most, from Central Asia. Anyway, when the invaders came in, they attacked the Little Kitej first, and they killed the prince's brother in battle. He was forced to flee to his newly built city in the forest. Batu captured a young man by the name of Grishka Kuterma, who was tortured, and when he couldn't endure that anymore, he gave up the location. Around the lake, and the invaders surrounded the city and sought to take it by force. They broke through the wall very quickly, but they saw something. The inhabitants of the city didn't build fortifications, interior fortifications. They weren't planning on defending themselves, largely because at that point it was impossible. The inhabitants simply prayed as, one man. Nothing good could be expected of this situation, except that. And as they rushed in, springs burst out of the ground. And when that happened, the Tartars retreated. These were very noisy, thousands of gallons. And by the time they got their act together, the entire city was underground. And in the distance, all they saw was a one solitary dome with a shining cross in the middle. And even that, you know, slowly sank into the water. So we're not just talking about this city and the monastery attached to it. But the path that Batu took is also itself part of this. Batu's path. Of course, we all have, as sinners, we all have traits like Batu, just we often don't have the opportunity to express it quite the way he did. But we're all sinners, self-righteous, egotistical, coming into the city, coming into the church, demanding this and demanding miracles and everything else. But as time goes on, we learn that that's simply not how it's done. You start off on this path, sinful, but you can have contact with the city only through purity. This path, it's the sinner slowly being enlightened by the gospel. Now, of course, since that time, the city either has been invisible or has functioned in some miraculous way under the waves. But the righteous can experience this, can see the lights of the processions more specifically, hear the ringing of its bells. There's people there today that swear to this, that they hear it. For the unbelievers, it's the true church that, because of everything that, you know, Peter the Great and everything that came from the reform before that, it exists only in a material and almost ghostly form. No one actually thinks it's literally under the water, but it's no longer material. And from not even the late 19th century, but certainly from the Revolution on, it's been a very popular symbol, even when it's used in a secular sense, which of course is an abuse because it's not a secular legend. And there are some expeditions in the late 1990s to this area, kind of in the middle of nowhere, but still in European Russia. It's a strong element of oral folklore, living oral folklore, especially there. And it has, in this case, a precisely designated center. It's in the Semenovsky district of Lower Novgorod province. But it's turned into a powerful symbol in the true sense of the word symbol, both of the ethnic Russian as well as the Orthodox identity. And you see it all over the place, both in, you know, often in secular writers, but in one form or another, whether you be an old believer or whoever, it is a symbol for old Russia. It's a symbol for the ascetic life and Moscow as the Third Rome. Now, of course, everything good gets abused and distorted. It's been transformed, especially since the revolution or just before it. But these transformations reflect the crisis of what Russia is, something that marked the fate of the Russian nation in the 20th century. So now it refers to just any old utopian project rather than a specifically Orthodox and religious old Russian idea. Now, the folk legend, which is still alive in that area, and the old believers, at least some of the more radical ones, the wanderers, the so-called runners, tend to accept this in one form or another. Because when everything, when all civil life is under the direct control of Antichrist, the only thing that can remain, however temporary, is something like this mystic city under the waves. But the area and the connection between a city, fortress, and monastery, for, you know, very good reason, starts to get foggy. It's all three and none of them. But it's because of this city's subordinos, their prayer as one man. This is the power that sunk the city into the lake. After the army of St. George was destroyed, defending this area, even Even the women took up arms. Now, that conflicts with the initial idea that no one there was going to fight. And that's both meant to be symbolic and literal. Now, there's another version of this. They all kind of say the same thing, but in different ways. In another version, the Mongols besieged the city during Bright Week of Matins, meaning the Paschal Matins. And the Ketesians prayed to the Mother of God to at least allow them to finish and then to protect the temple from blasphemy, from destruction, and to save their lives. And God then commanded the Archangel Michael to immerse the city in the lake. Maxim Gorky actually mentions this in his part of his autobiography from the people in 1916, that his grandmother told him stories like that. Now, you have European legends about sunken cities. The examples that most people cite are the Greek legend of Sybaris, even the Breton legend of the city of Ish. But in this case, the disappearance of the city underwater is not a sign of God's wrath or punishment, but mercy. There's something very similar. In 1821, Adam Mickiewicz, the Polish national poet, wrote in his Fityaz, and he took a Lithuanian legend about a disappearance of the city of the same name, in the lake of the same name. On the surface, it sounds very similar. The city sinks at the prayer of the young princess, who didn't want to surrender to the Russian army, in this case, it surrounded them. And clearly, the similarities are obvious. And the city goes into the invisible world, which is probably the best way to put it, fleeing from a foreign army, which is very similar to the Russian version. Now, problem is that Mickiewicz's main character, the princess, becomes a mermaid, and her friends become flowers on the shore. So in that sense, it's a bit different. But Ketesh still lives today. It just exists in another world, at the bottom, so to speak, of the lake, remaining invisible to, I think, the common run of people. But according to the folk legends, the righteous and the pious can not only see this city under certain conditions, but can actually enter into it. What we're talking about here is, you know, this is associated primarily with the faithfulness to the Orthodox truth. In the 1960s, Archbishop John of San Francisco, not Maximovich, Sokolsky, talked about this thirst for the truth of modern people. And he called it the Svetlar consciousness among the people. And he wrote an article called The Bottom of Svetlar. And he interprets it as the legend of a city of people who observed the truth of God and those who did not give up the church of the holy faith to be blasphemed. He said in the 20th century, this became an expression of Russian culture itself. Now, after the revolution, it makes a lot of sense, because the Orthodox faith here that nourished this culture can only exist in the Soviet Union secretly. Of course, the old believers have been doing that for a very long time prior to this. You have a lot of pilgrimages, especially of the old rite, to this lake. Nikolai Tolstoy, not the famous one, of course, he went in the 1980s, and he wrote, he said, you know, Ketesh continues to be perceived by pilgrims as, and I'm quoting here, a host of living temples, bells ringing, morning and evening services, as materially and concretely existing, but invisible or visible, not to everyone and not always. And in this, according to the popular idea, there is nothing unusual, because Ketesh is marked with the seal of holiness and heroic feats, and the lake is marked with the same. So the literary form here, again, old believers made it popular. Whether or not the Ketesh Chronicle was really written then, but it emerged anyway in the second half of the 18th century. And it came not just with the old believers, but usually the priestless. And this is where, you know, in the 18th century, people like Dmitri Likhachev talks about St. George II, Vsevolodovich. Now, he fell in battle with the Tartars on the Sit River near Tver, canonized later, but his connection with Little Likhachev is quite real, because that was in a different location. Before the occupation of Vladimir Suzdal, the prince traveled there for an inheritance. In 1237, which is the same year that the chronicle was written, or at least compiled, when Batu's men approached Vladimir, George then went to Yaroslav, where in this case, to defend Little Kitej, that's where the battle took place, and of course he had lost. The chronicle actually doesn't talk about the miraculous salvation, the submersion of this. They only say that the wicked Tsar Batu, the Mongol, killed the blessed Prince George and ruined his cities. Little Kitej on the banks of the Volga, and Great Kitej also on the banks of the Svetlyar Lake. Now, there is a specific 18th century Old Believer manuscript called The Tale and the Punishment of the Hidden City of Kitej. It doesn't provide the historical background that the chronicle does. It stresses the utopian, in a sense, earthly paradise. For the first time, and this is actually the first time where the city is spoken of as a city of the pious, it opens only to the true Orthodox. The point of the story is to escape the filth of the world, which is a quote, but you need somewhere to escape to. Because in the more radical priestless sects of the Guild Rite, the modern world itself is, by its very structure, the kingdom of Antichrist. It's not a foretaste of Antichrist. It's not ushering in Antichrist. It is Antichrist. Many of the old believers held to the view that the Antichrist is not a person, not an individual. It's a mentality. It's an oligarchic system of rule, Judaic at its core. Now, the interest in the old believers developed really with Pavel Milinkov-Tersky. And he studied the old rite, using the folk legends about Kitej as key to understanding them. There's a story. He wrote a poem called Grisha, 1861. Grisha is, we've already mentioned him, as someone who gave up the location. And he was, but in this story, he's a pious young man, depressed over the idea of this universal apostasy. And he comes across a wanderer, one of the runners, a Drellian, very odd name. He hears about it for the first time. Now, like the basic poetic cycle of the city, he tells him that Kitej was inhabited by very pious people, that in fact were so pious that they could directly experience heaven itself. To be with them, according to this man, according to this elder, this wanderer, it's only possible through absolute obedience to your elder, in the true faith, in this case, the more extreme Popotzi faction of the old belief. Grisha is captivated by this. But he doesn't seem to understand what righteousness is. So, to shorten this here, seeking righteousness, he attacks a man who robbed a pious widow. He wasn't doing it at the moment. This was just a revenge thing, thinking he's doing something. Her child thanks him, and the pious widow dies almost immediately from shock. So he's done nothing. He thought this was going to earn him admittance to Kitej. But it's meant to imply that in the pursuit of the city, at least with that mentality, it leads not to piety, but crime and violence. That in this case, the pursuit of this sacred city is an instrument of terrible spiritual delusion. In Greece, Alexander Ismailio, reviewing the poem, and he says, the Russian soul appears like a blind Samson who will fall off a cliff or be led off a cliff by the first charmer he comes across. In other words, this is a breeding ground for fraudsters. Apollyon Maikov changed the plot of Grisha, and he wrote a play called The Wanderer, which came out in 1867. He also uses Grisha, who is in the initial description. He also has a mistress named Fenka. He does come across a wanderer who declares that the whole world is mired in evil, and just like the other poem, it captivates the pious young man when he hears about the wonderful spiritual life of people who live in this city, and it's made clear to him. At the end of it, he's escaping into the desert, and he and friends not only rob, but set fire to the house of the man who apparently deserved it, the guy who in the initial story attacked the widow. So not only do they attack the guy, they kill him and they burn everything he has. Now, the poem was a success. Even Dostoevsky called this a masterpiece. But the real impetus to rediscovering this came from Milinkov-Pchersky's In the Forest, between 1871 and 1874. I'm quoting from it here. The legends about Batu's defeat are fresh there. They also indicate the path of Batu and the place of the invisible city of Katej on Lake Svetliar. That city is still intact, white stone walls, golden dome churches, but sinful people will not see. And until now, the city is invisible. It will open, though, before the terrible judgment seat of Christ. On the Lake Svetliar, in a quiet summer evening, walls, churches, monasteries, princely towers, mansions reflected in the water can be seen in the yards of the city's people. And the dull, mournful ringing of bells is heard at night from Katej, or so they say, beyond the Volga. Now, the phrase beyond the Volga is not accidental. It's a clear reference to the Transvolgan elders, so-called non-possessors, led by St. Niels Sorsky, who stressed the life of the hermitage, or the skete, over the more typical Athenite forms of communal monasticism. Now, as I've said before, a long time ago, the confrontation between possessors and non-possessors is a myth. The mentality here is clear, though regardless of that. The characters in this novel make a pilgrimage to the shores of the lake, where scribes and peasants, dreaming of seeing this invisible city, argue with one another about how to find it. They argue theology. And he says, and I'm quoting here, and you will see the bird of paradise walks along the street, and wonderful unicorns, lions, and tame dragons stand at the city gates instead of human guards. This is the kind of mentality that he experiences here. One of the pilgrims tells about his friend who read about this city in books, learned the way to find it from an old believer abbot named Father Mikhail, and then set off. He took Batu's path, led him to a green meadow, which very quickly turned into a treacherous swamp, quagmire. He barely escaped it, and right afterwards he fell into the clutches of a bear and returned home, a broken man. The narrator here is Andrei Pitersky, with the obvious implications of his name, the Kiev Caves founder. He's able to share the faith of the peasants that are always gathered by the lake. The author is more concerned, as I've already said, describing it from a more social and cultural point of view. At the turn of the 20th century, Katej had this upsurge in interest, and the concept attracted figures of every possible background, you know, for better or for worse, and turned it into one of their central symbols here. And it's really under the impression of this book, The Forest, where Nikolai Rimsky-Korsakov conceived the idea of the legend of the invisible city of Katej and the Virgin of Fervonia. And it became that in and of itself. The play and the opera that come from it. It was no longer on the periphery of Russian culture, and also not only the domain of the unbelievers. Now, it's been a long time since I've spoken of the symbolists. This is an aesthetic and philosophical school, roughly around the turn of the 20th century, the so-called Silver Age of Russian literature. And it has good elements, and it has really bad elements, including the, you know, Satanism of Zinaida Gippius, who even she tried to, she wrote Bright Lake in 1908. But the symbolist movement, which was deeply Platonic and anti-nominalist, anti-urban to a great extent, took this and ran with it, again, for better or for worse. And it wasn't so much visible only to those who were holy, but visible to those who were initiated. It was a very different story. In 1903, Dmitry Medvedevsky visited the lake, and he summarized his impressions in his article, Religion and Revolution, that same year, 1908. And the tendency is for the symbolists, you know, mostly poets, to see this semi-religious arcana in this story, the basis of the coming Russian spirituality. Russian spirituality that hasn't shown up yet, but so many of them, despite all the verbiage, you know, they're called symbolists for a reason. Their rhetoric is at the expense of old Russia, which they not only rejected, but hated. Now, not all symbolists were like this. Ivanov and Bloch may be saved from some of this, but those two certainly were. And Medvedevsky wrote the novel Peter and Alexei, 1905, which is part of the trilogy Christ and Antichrist. There, it's a little bit more tolerable, and this is one of the reasons I got into the symbolist movement in the first place. They posit Katej as the opposite, the counterpart, but also the opposite of the St. Petersburg occult dystopia. There's a God seeker, which in and of itself, I mean, the Orthodox Church in 1905 was present, whether old believer or not, so you didn't have to be seeking anything. But in the story, the hero of the novel is named Tikhon, which anyone in Russian literature named Tikhon is a religious figure of one kind or another. But I do like this line, and they're talking about, they're contrasting Katej with St. Petersburg. And he says that this whole city would rise together with the fog and scatter like a dream. In Katej, true reality is invisible. But here in Petersburg, on the contrary, unreality is visible. But both cities are equally ghostly, and an eerie sense of the end was born in him again. Now, while I love that concept, that in Katej, you know, what is real is not visible, in St. Petersburg, what is visible is not real, that whole movement, Medvedevsky in particular, sees the monarchy, the state, and the Orthodox Church as evil. And not really even in the sense of the wanderers. But Tikhon is certain that running away from all of this, at least running away from St. Petersburg, is necessary, but he doesn't know where to go. But here's the choices that he put in front of himself. He says, it was necessary to decide. It was necessary to choose one of two options, to the west, with Pastor Gluck, to the city of glass, or to the east, with the elder Cornelius, to the invisible city of Katej. Now, this is a positive aspect of the symbolism. Pastor Gluck obviously refers to German Protestantism, but the City of Glass refers to the Crystal Palace, which Dostoevsky argued was a monument to the Faustian nature of the modern West, and of course it is. It's a deeply occult structure. But it isn't like he says, we want to go to the Old Believer Parish, we want to go to a monastery. No, we need to go to somewhere that's invisible, meaning that no good existed in Russia at the time he wrote this. So in that mentality, the city became a symbol of the spiritual quest which unfortunately has Masonic overtones to it. So on the one hand, the symbolists have this very healthy Platonic approach to the world, and they use that to fight the Faustian positivist Western world. But they also fight the Orthodox Church and the Crown with it. Now, as I mentioned, the young man who got so excited over hearing about Katez from Father Mikhail, it's really worse than in Milinkov-Pacharsky's story. Father Mikhail turns out to be a total fraud. He leads a Jonestown-style mass suicide, and he's the only survivor because he had no intention of killing himself. Because of that, now he wasn't a part of it, he certainly was a witness to it, though. The hero of the novel loses all faith in it. And his experience brings him to an arcane occult religion. Maximilian Voloshin, another one, in his poem Katez, 1919, he treats this underwater city as the eternal dream of the Russian population. But again, he holds the view that the real history of Russia throughout its entire length is mired in evil. Holy Russia is something that exists but has never actually existed in physical form. In other words, it has no points of contact with earthly existence, which of course doesn't make any sense. But, you know, they're called symbolists for a reason. He even says in his poem, and it's extremely difficult to translate poetry, and I did a very poor job of it, but you get the gist of it here, which isn't what symbolism is about. But Holy Rus, he says, is covered with sinful Russia. And there are no ways to enter that city, for the conscript and the alien call to the evangelism of the underwater church. The point is that the city really doesn't exist. And that also means that the foundation of the legend thus is corrupt. In other words, they're using a symbol of folk wisdom to promote an ideology that will destroy this folk wisdom. The peasantry that's hopelessly backward. Although certainly not all symbolists believe this, and nor are they consistent on this kind of thing anyway. There, Peter the First is a manifestation of Antichrist. In Voloshin's Katez story, says that the heirs of Peter made the country, quote, German, dignified, and vile. And specifically there, he is in reference to the Masonic state erected under Lord Byron in the middle of the 18th century, which I've dealt with in my writings at length. The only ray of light, he says, the only thing worthwhile in any of this is that there's a popular belief in this invisible city. Underwater, the underwater city, you could hear it. You hear it at the bottom of your soul. And he says, pray be patient, except there is a cross on the shoulders and a throne in the neck. And at the bottom of the soul, the underwater Katej hums an impossible dream. And what he's saying, of course, is that the cross and the church and the throne are burdens. They're not good things, they're bad things. And if the dream is impossible, there's no point in even talking about it. Voloshin has another poem called Holy Russia. Actually, it's a cycle of poetry called The Waves of Russia. And again, this is 1917, where he mocks the church and supports the revolution. And on the one hand, he says it's foolish, but there's also a religious aspect of foolishness, a special kind of holiness. The holy fool, just like in Katez, in this mentality, is not a religious conception. It's mocking, and it exists in opposition to old Russia. In other words, the affirmation of one is possible only at the expense of another. To the point where even people like, Voloshin himself, in 1919, he said that Holy Russia is spread by the Bolsheviks, but banned by the police. The image of this city, and there was a Soviet literature on Katej, and one of them was in Glakluev, became one of his major themes. The invisible city becomes the poet's personification of peasant culture. And in this case, it's, of course, opposed to Antichrist and the Antichrist urban civilization. But be careful when poets use words, because, of course, the whole point of poetry is you're not using them in the normal sense. Kluwer is talking about this ecumenical utopia, typical of that era. And he says this, and again, he says, the birch bark savior kisses a saffron brown. Rus flows into the great pyramid in Babylon to the gardens of Semiramis. Now, this man did have old believer roots, and he was also, like many of the symbolists involved in pagan cults. He says, behind the Eucharist of shamans, I drank blood and fire, the list of Vedas from Lhasa, the silk book and the horoscope Buddha I read at the age of 15. But this is exactly the context where Ketej arrives. But this is the mentality of that Silver Age, at least in some of the more extreme symbolists. But Kluwer defined it that Ketej is significant only insofar as it contains, quote, the greatest secret of esoteric peasant conduct. Esoteric peasant conduct. To try to make the argument that peasants had an esoteric side, they may have had a side that people don't understand, but that's not the same thing as being esoteric. He wrote an article called Precious Blood, From the Golden Letter to the Communist Brethren, 1919. I mean, really, there's no need to prove that secret esoteric cults were not a part of the religion of the Russian peasantry. It's not accidental for him also to address the Communist Brethren. It's the revolution that the poet saw in the dream of the holy city come true. Of course, abusing Ketej as what's being created by the revolution, actually says this. He says, what the Republic is to the mind, Ketej is to the heart. And by the Republic, of course, it's the post-Tsarist provisional government. Rus Ketej came out that same year. He had a whole cycle of poetry called Lenin in 1918-1919. But in his really bad attempt, you know, remember, there's not a whole lot of room for poetry in the Marxist system. It's prosaic and literal, and they at least claim that it's scientific. It's like the bourgeois worldview. It's jejune. It's hackneyed. And people like this don't seem to notice that the Soviet state, which he personifies by Lenin, has explicitly and loudly severed any continuity with old Russia, the context from which the legend of Ketej was born. Of course, they're aware of this. They're simply using a popular symbol for their own purposes. Another poem from the same author, 1917, called Red Song. And he's talking about the revolution's battle with the old world, or old Russia, which he calls the golden calf, which is hated. Ketezgrad, the incense of sawed-off pines, this is our beloved dear paradise. For the earth, for freedom, for the bread of labor, we are going to battle with our enemies. The mention of Sarov, of course, has nothing to do with St. Seraphim. In fact, he talks about this as its inversion, to be baptized into the lion's red faith, and then to kill the white guards for spitting on the red god. And he mocks the priesthood as snakes hiss through the cathedrals. 1918 poem, of course, he calls the revolution the mother of light. And he takes the prayer, ancient prayer to the mother of God, and just replaces that word with revolution. So, the way to Ketej, just like when we talked about the poem Grisha, it lies through murder. Yes, they can build a purely materialist Ketej, which really is nonsensical. But that's the abuse of the concept. And it came up in the past. Mayakov, Milinkov-Pichersky, portrayed this as a great spiritual danger. You know, the beating up of the guy who may well have deserved it, burning stuff down, trying to find righteousness through some kind of heroic, violent act. That's exactly the danger that they want to avoid, but that's exactly what Kluwer and people like him praise as an act of great heroism. But soon, the ecstasy of the revolution will pass, and there's nothing left but the state machine. But like so many of these guys, Kluwev, near the end of his life, the early 30s, and really he says it in Rus Ketej, he says, the plant, meaning the industrial plant, the plant spews into Svetlyar, blast furnace burping, slags a firefly. For a year, Russia will glow in the dark. And he's starting to be disillusioned by the system, as so many of these people were. You see, another law of social science, which I don't think I came up with, but it's not like Johnson's law, but it's similar in the sense that I don't care how wonderful an ideology is, I don't care how in words and on paper and in speech, how everything fits together coherently in this beautiful understanding of the world, the minute it gets imposed on people, the minute you need institutions and police forces and factories and everything else to make it come alive, it's eventually going to have no bearing whatsoever on the initial ideology that you've read or that you've heard. It always gets corrupted just because the order eventually of this movement will fall away and you have to get to the day-to-day dirty life of governing. And this is one of the huge problems of creating a system based on an ideology written on paper. And this is what he means by this, the slags, the blast furnaces, and all the talk about, you know, the liberation of the worker is absolutely nonsense. It's words on a page. But there was this transformation of Ketej, the old believer idea, and people like the symbolists, Medikovsky, Voloshin, Kluwev. But in these symbolist circles, turn of the 20th century, the relationship between Holy Russia and Russia as such has to be understood not really as between and as this ideal and its imperfect earthly embodiment, but a complete and total opposition. In order for the ideal Russia, there, when they use the word Holy Russia, for it to finally triumph, according to this logic, you have to destroy old Russia. And that's how they use the term. The two of them can't coexist. And this is one of the reasons that the city, the legend became popular amongst the young believers, because there was no Holy Russia anymore. But the ideal still exists. It still exists somewhere, and it exists, among other places, at the bottom of the lake, metaphorically speaking. But after in the modern era, the late 19th, early 20th century, this literary idea, you know, poets are not going to use a word in its day-to-day usage. You could just say it then. Words like holy or the folk or the people, I've been through this before, they're not used in the normal sense. The meaning is very different. This is the difference between esoteria and exoteria. And people like Sergei Yesenin, where, you know, he curses the breath of Ketej in 1918, and as the 20th century continued, the hatred of the church from this relatively small literary minority got worse. Ivan Bunin, who I've mentioned a few times before, answered all of this to the 50th anniversary of the death of Mr. Alexei Tolstoy in 1925. Alexei Tolstoy, of course, is very different from his very distant relative. But he's talking about Russian civilization. And he condemns the revolution and brings the understanding of Ketej to where it's supposed to be. And he talks about the Kyrgyz Kaisak as the Asiatic nomad aiming his arrows at us. And he uses a toponym, Ketej, as the equivalent of old Russia. And he's very clear. He says there's two irreconcilable camps. People like Tolstoy, the sons of Holy Russia, people who understand Ketej, and as he says, the Kosmonol Yesenins. And he makes reference, I mean, the Rus Ketej is contrasted with the Asian desert. there, the Kyrgyz archer. Russian reality became a salt marsh. And there was a few thinkers in the early part of the 20th century that, and Bunin was one of them, who saw the revolution and as a victory of the, quote, Asian principle over the European one. And then he says that the genuine national tradition, and Alexei Tolstoy says the same thing, unites Russia with Christian Europe. He says, where do you get the idea that we're antipodes of Europe? A Mongolian cloud passed over us, but that was just a cloud. No, Russians are still Europeans, not Mongols. He says, no, our Russian Rus is alive. We don't need Tartar Russia, as he's mocking the people who we've been talking about here. The defeat of historical Russia, old Russia in the Civil War, immediately brought back associations with the fate of Katyusha. The city began to embody what it's supposed to, the very opposite of what the symbolists had stated, the Orthodox state, the Orthodox faith, and the way of life. Boris Zaitsev wrote in his Vendée epilogue, the very fact that he uses the word Vendée, the counter-revolutionaries in France, in amongst the symbolists, it was the gospel that drove them away to try to find this Katyusha. Here, it's your first step. They're recovering the old concept. Yes, the visible church has imperfections, but it's an irrational jump to say that, therefore, the invisible church doesn't exist. And even the great Ivan Ilyin, in his set of speeches called About Russia in 1926, he was very interested in this topic. And he interprets the recovery of Katyusha, understood as a desire of the people's soul not to flee from the world, but to religiously accept and religiously comprehend it, to deepen and sanctify our way of life, including our sufferings. He doesn't see the history of Russia as eternal rebellion like the left does, but fruitful creation. And he sees Katyusha as the symbol that inspires this creation. And he says explicitly, he says, in the dense spiritual thicket, we found a mysterious spiritual lake, and from it we received our wisdom, and from it we led our gathering we gathered our forces and our struggle. And only at times, exhausted from the burden, discouraged, entangled in the thicket, the Russian people lost their way to Katyusha, betrayed the ministry, and fell into turmoil. Ilyin even says, Russia will be resurrected, and he says, for the Lord of our Katyusha is with us. He talks about Russian endurance. You see a recovery, although not completely, of the idea as a revolution really showed what it truly is. And as the Soviet Union developed and showed its true face, which frankly, you know, it wasn't too shy about talking about in the very beginning anyway, but once it became too great to ignore, and since the church then had to function in secret, Katyusha became extremely important. Archbishop John, as I mentioned before, not the Archbishop John, San Francisco, in the poem that I mentioned already, or the article, I should say, and he talks about Solzhenitsyn's concern with this very topic. He doesn't talk about it much. But what he says is, Alexander Solzhenitsyn is given to touch this mystery these days of Svetlur. He sees a place where the supreme truth is hidden from the noisy and empty world and the noisy and empty words. The term Katyusha only appears in Solzhenitsyn's, I think, one time, the bell tower, 1996, describing the city on the Volga, Kalyazin. It was because most of it was flooded by a failed Soviet construction project, which happens quite a bit, actually. And it was the highest-built bell tower that was left over, reminded everyone of the beauty of the former Russian town. And clearly the connection with Katyusha makes a lot of sense in that case. But the old belief, again, I know I went far afield here, but I want to quote Nikolai Berdyaev, who, to a great extent, was sympathetic with the old belief. Let me talk about it. He mentions the Russian schism. This is what he says. The schism was a departure from history because history was taken over by the prince of this world, the Antichrist, who penetrated to the top of the church and state. The Orthodox kingdom thus goes underground, and the true kingdom is the city of Gtez, located under the lake. And he shows a great degree of sympathy, which you may be surprised to learn, with the old belief. But in the minds of the old belief, especially the priestless, from the waters of that hidden existence, the great symbol still remains of the undistorted Christianity in that city. It wasn't an invented myth, according to them. It was reanimated. It's the folk memory of Holy Russia. It's the folk memory of Russia prior to Peter the Great. That's what it is, regardless of how the chronicle, you know, may make errors here and there. That's really insignificant. In the metaphysics of the old believers, which you know I've written on to great length, Kitez under the waters is material, but it's glorified matter. It's not sensory matter. It requires contemplation and a true understanding of the faith. And it will show itself just before the second coming. It's the point of connection between the glorified matter and the sensory fallen matter. And part of the metaphysics of the old belief, they emphasize something that doesn't come up much. It's the true attitude towards the material world, matter as such. Prior to the fall, it was pure. It was a conduit for the energy of God. And it's only sin that introduces evil and decay into it. And wherever the church is to be found, matter is pure. But only once it's redeemed. But for someone who doesn't understand that, for the earthly person, for the worldly person, as they would say, Kitez is immaterial. It's a ghost. And he goes so far, people like VP Shestakov, an old believer writer, who says, despite the fact that Kitez is removed from the sinful world, that's run from it, the people who live there are unhappy. Because the fall of the Muscovite kingdom has not been restored. And they pray and struggle for the former grace to the world. But of course, the apostasy, according to them, is irreversible. The old believer tale, the city of Kitej, this is about entering into the city. If a person promises to enter, if he promises not falsely, and from his zeal begins to fast and sheds tears and seeks it, he promises to fast, to die by starvation rather than leave it, to endure many other sorrows, and to know that God will save him. His every step will be known and recorded by an angel of God. And in these kind of words, this is a spiritual manifesto of some of the more extreme old believers, a guide to their organization. It's a consolidating aspect to the old believer priestless movement. And they make pilgrimages all the time. They have prayer services at the lake and all that. And they see it as a place that's especially close to God. Anyway, we're coming to the end here. This symbol is an extremely powerful one. But it can't be entirely severed from our visible church and our visible world. Because if there was no point of contact, then there would be no purpose even in talking about it. It would abolish itself. There'd be no unity of the church here. The path of the invisible city is open to all ascetics, but it is very narrow. The Chronicle, a later addition to the Chronicle says, he who does not desire nor strives, desires to be saved. The Lord doesn't force people to do this. But when someone with an undivided mind, undoubted faith, promises and thinks nothing vain in himself and not tell anybody and never turn back, the Lord will open the gates. There are righteous people living there. It's only when people waver and doubt and are not willing to suffer. The self-righteous will be shown just an empty space, a forest, a lake. Everything will be a reproach to him. And both right belief and right action are necessary for salvation. And only then is a city visible to anybody. The traveler has to reject everything earthly and sever all earthly attachments. He has to partake of the sacraments and spurn his possessions without supplies and total humility, and then he'll see it. And in fact, there's even another version of this word. Little Katej is the city of passions and sins, and only once you overcome those will the greater city be opened. There are two Russias, and I'm going to end with in the Psychology of the Russian Schism in 1896, Vasily Razanov. He says there are two Russias. One is the Russia of appearances, a mass of external forms with regular outlines, with events that have a definite start and finish. The empire, the history of which Karamzin depicted, developed by Soloviev, the laws which were codified by Speransky. However, there's another, Holy Russia, Mother Russia, whose laws are mysterious, obscure forms, indefinite currents, the end of which is not foreseeable and the origin unknown. The Russia of essence, its living blood and untouched faith, where every fact is not an artificial cohesion with another, but with the strength of one's own being. The legend of the city, of course, now miraculously saved from God by devastation, sheltered and saved until better times, when it will again appear to the world, retaining its ancient roots, faith, and truth. This is one of the most extraordinary legends of the Russian nation, a nation centuries subjugated to invasions of internal and external enemies. Thank you, everyone, for listening. I'll talk to you next time. Bye-bye.